Nations from across the globe are supposed to convene in Scotland in November for a major climate summit. Many delegates are coming from places where most people are not yet vaccinated.
Right, so for us, the best and most logical solution would be to postpone.
Also today, one legacy of life after 9/11.
There's very few people who are able to just call themselves American without a hyphen of some kind or a dash that pre-qualifies their Americanness.
Reflecting on what it means to be Muslim in America today, and we remember one of Afghanistan's most revered guerrilla fighters killed on this day 20 years ago.
Never he liked war. Once he told me that, I hate war. He said that I'm fighting to bring peace, not to love war.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. Every year, delegates from around the world get together to try and chart a future to beat back climate change. In less than 2 months, they'll meet in Glasgow, Scotland. This one is being seen as a major summit. The last truly significant gathering was in France 6 years ago when countries signed the Paris Agreement, a pledge to dramatically cut greenhouse gas emissions across the globe. This year's meeting in Glasgow was delayed for a year because of the pandemic. Some activists are calling for another postponement. Here's The World's environment correspondent, Carolyn Beeler.
The November summit is officially called COP26, a.k.a. the 26th Conference of the Parties. Its president, Alok Sharma, dubbed it something more pointed recently in a video.
What COP26 really stands for is our last chance to avoid the worst effects of climate change.
The summit serves as a deadline for governments to set new targets for cutting carbon emissions, targets they hope will keep alive the goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
And we can only succeed if we act now to speed up the shift to our green future.
This sense of urgency is widely shared by the 25,000 people expected in Scotland this fall. But even still, some activist groups say holding the meeting amid a widening vaccine gap would be unfair and unsafe.
We need to ensure a safe and equitable COP, right? So for us, the best and most logical solution would be to postpone.
Tasnim Esop leads Climate Action Network International, which represents more than 1,500 environmental organizations. Her group's call this week to postpone was echoed by Greenpeace and others. It comes as vaccination rates in the U.S. and Europe top 60% or 70%, but are in the single digits for many countries in Asia and Africa.
We're not going to have vaccine equity by November, and now time is running out.
The UK government says it will provide vaccines to conference attendees who can't get them at home. A spokesperson tells The World the AstraZeneca vaccines will start being administered this week. Mexican activist Maria Reyes says members of her group, Fridays for Future, are still waiting for their shots.
Some of us registered under the UK vaccination program, but all we have gotten so far is useless emails.
Reyes finally traveled to the U.S. to get her jab this week. But despite the logistical hurdles, she's against delaying the summit.
We cannot wait for the COP to be postponed again. And I feel like just calling for a postponement is driving the attention from what's actually necessary, and that's vaccine equity and equity on their restrictions generally.
She's talking about quarantine rules. Summit attendees from countries with high COVID rates must quarantine for up to 10 days at a cost of more than $3,000. The UK government announced this week it would pay for these costs, but Reyes still bristles at being put in what she thinks of as a COVID jail. And travel restrictions are another hurdle. Lavetta Nalangi Seru is an organizer in Fiji, where the borders are still closed and regular flights suspended.
To, you know, even consider attending a conference, it's on a case-by-case basis, and government decides, you know, who leaves and who does not.
Developing countries have lobbied against a virtual conference, in part to avoid any problems with internet bandwidth. Now, their biggest fear is that those most impacted by climate change will be effectively shut out of the talks if they can't get there. Here's Tasnim Esop again.
The worst case scenario would be that we have a COP with a whole lot of rich nations.
Nations, she points out, that did the most to cause climate change and also have the most access to vaccines.
And that it would leave out the important issues that developing countries and especially vulnerable countries are concerned about.
Issues like more funding to adapt to climate change and compensation for damages. The UK government said it's working tirelessly to ensure an inclusive, accessible, and safe summit. The summit will go on, the government said, because, quote, we're all too aware climate change has not taken time off. For The World, I'm Carolyn Buehler.
President Biden is making a major speech today on getting the pandemic under control, a broad plan to push businesses, schools, and federal agencies to get stricter about COVID vaccines. In Zimbabwe and Southern Africa, the message for the country's 300,000 state workers is more draconian: get the COVID vaccine or resign. Only about 11% of Zimbabwe's population is fully vaccinated, but that does mean there's a surplus of shots to be administered to those state workers that could keep them from losing their jobs and keep them healthy. Norman Matara heads up the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights, a professional organization in Zimbabwe. Dr. Matara, do you support the Zimbabwean government demanding that state workers get the vaccine or resign?
We think that the decision by the government is too harsh at the moment. And we believe that we need to get the buy-in of people into accepting the vaccines and not punish them by mandating the vaccines at the moment. So we believe this is the wrong move, and it will send a wrong signal to people who are already hesitant to get the vaccine.
And how do you propose getting that buy-in?
First of all, is to try and get different variety of vaccines, because at the moment, we are only getting the Chinese vaccines, and some people are skeptical to get these vaccines. So even getting the other vaccines like the Moderna, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson, AstraZeneca, try and make public health professionals be on the lead in terms of pushing the vaccine agenda, because at the moment, it's being pushed by politicians. And in Zimbabwe, most people do not trust our politicians. So this is something why people are not getting the vaccine.
But there is, as you said, a vaccine available, the Chinese one, Sinovac. Why are people in Zimbabwe not taking that one?
First of all, it was the way it was introduced. I think it was rushed without people getting educated about the vaccines. And then there were some messages that leaked, clips of people saying that these vaccines are dangerous to people who have comorbidities like hypertension, HIV, diabetes, and things like that. Even up to now, most people think that if you have a comorbidity, you can't take these vaccines. So people are a bit hesitant. Some people also hesitant because the global conspiracy theories surrounding vaccines, that they've been developed so quickly, they are not safe. And then lastly, and most importantly, the politics of it. You know, with the coming in of the Chinese vaccines, people in Zimbabwe do not trust Chinese products. We have a long history of getting cheap products from China, which doesn't last. So when we heard that the vaccines are coming from China, most people didn't trust the vaccines, as well as when we introduced them, they had not yet been approved by the World Health Organization, and people were a bit hesitant.
So, doctor, when we look at the statistic of 11% of Zimbabwe's population vaccinated, you're saying misinformation, mistrust in Chinese products, all leading to vaccine hesitancy. Are there any other reasons for the hesitancy in Zimbabwe?
You know, Zimbabweans are very religious and they follow their religious leaders, what they say. And unfortunately, at the beginning of the vaccination agenda, some religious leaders who have got a very huge following of up to millions went against the vaccine publicly to say that this is going to cause more harm than good. And most people listen to those people in Zimbabwe. And that's another factor as well.
How easy is it right now for a person in Zimbabwe to get the COVID vaccine there?
I would say it's relatively easy for anyone who wants to get the vaccine to get vaccinated. Luckily for us, we already had a very robust expanded program of immunization for the under fives, and we used those structures to penetrate even up to the rural areas to provide the vaccines. So the vaccines are being given in all the major hospitals, in clinics, and as of the last 2 months, even the private sector is also administering the vaccine.
Are medical professionals in Zimbabwe getting vaccinated? And can I ask if you are?
Yes, I am vaccinated. I was vaccinated in April, and I think most medical professionals are vaccinated. I don't have a figure of head, but from just the general view of seeing our colleagues, I think almost all of my colleagues are already vaccinated. So I think the health professionals are indeed vaccinated.
Dr. Matara, if you could advise the Zimbabwean government, what would you tell them to do to try to counter vaccine hesitancy?
We should stop politicizing the vaccines. We should let the science lead, let the health professionals lead, and try not to scare people into taking the vaccine, but rather try to educate people so that they make an informed decision. We've done a lot of talk to people in companies as an association, and we've seen that just talking to the people and giving them information will result in change in behavior. And many people have taken the vaccine who had been hesitant before because they have seen that professionals talked to them and they really understood what we told. We allayed their fears regarding the vaccine and they changed their minds. So we can do a similar approach as a nation and we can counter vaccine hesitancy.
Norman Mataro is with the Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights, a professional organization in Zimbabwe. Dr. Mataro, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
The conflict in Ethiopia's northern Tigray region has now dragged on for more than 10 months. Since the start of the fighting, there have been reports of terrible human rights violations, and the violence is spilling beyond Ethiopia's northernmost province. This week, Ethiopian officials said that Tigrayan rebels recently killed more than 120 people in the neighboring Amhara region. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi brings us this update.
When the fighting in Tigray began last November, Ethiopia's Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed pledged a quick victory against the Tigray People's Liberation Front, or TPLF. That was after the group attacked a federal military base in the north. Even then, observers warned the conflict could spread out of control, and that's exactly what's happening now. Here's what U.S. Deputy Representative to the United Nations, Richard Mills, said 2 weeks ago.
The Ethiopian government has not responded positively to proposals for negotiations. Instead, it has publicly called for the mobilization of militia.
Tigrayan forces are also ramping up the fight, emboldened by their recent victories against the Ethiopian government forces in Tigray. Here's Richard Mills again.
The TPLF, meanwhile, has expanded its own military campaign into the Afar and Amhara regions.
Amhara and Afar neighbor Tigray to the south and east. The fighting between the TPLF, Ethiopian troops, and various armed militias has displaced hundreds of thousands of people, says Saviano Abrio. He's a spokesman with the UN Humanitarian Office.
The number of people in need of urgent humanitarian assistance in these two regions, in addition to Tigray, is rising daily.
The World Food Program says more than 1.7 million people in the Amhara and Afar regions are now at risk of hunger. The WFP's Christine Hakonze is on the ground in Afar. Here's what she said in a video released this week.
This has just come to compound an already bad situation. So already people are food insecure, but this makes things completely worse.
Tigray has been essentially blocked off for nearly a year. Humanitarian groups have been using roads from Afar to access the war zone. But the UN's Saviano Abrio says that's becoming more difficult.
The spillover of the conflict is also complicating our operations inside Tigray as humanitarian access into Tigray.
Over the weekend, Abrio says a convoy of 150 trucks carrying humanitarian relief were allowed to enter Tigray, but that's only part of what's needed on a daily basis to meet people's basic needs. The spillover of the conflict has also brought a new wave of accusations of mass human rights violations.
In the case of atrocities against civilians, it has been happening in Tigray since the beginning of the conflict in November last year, and we condemn any kind of atrocities, the massacres.
This week, Ethiopian officials accused TPLF fighters of massacring more than 100 civilians in the Amhara region. They say the killing took place early in September. In a statement, the TPLF rejected claims that its forces have killed civilians. For The World, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
Coming up on the show, after 9/11, the U.S. government started a terrorist watch list. Many saw it as a great idea.
I thought it was amazing. I mean, when I looked at what it was and what it was going to do.
Now, 20 years on, we look back at the good and bad that came from that. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. It looked like a scene at pretty much any airport in the world. Passengers boarding an airport bus in an orderly manner, ferried across the tarmac to their flight. But this was Kabul, and the first commercial airliner out of Afghanistan since the U.S. withdrew all of its troops at the end of August. More than 100 passengers, including Americans, managed to board the Qatar Airways flight bound for Doha. One major hurdle getting the flight out all the damage to the airport infrastructure from the chaotic evacuations in recent weeks. Technical teams from Turkey and Qatar stepped in to restore operations. Qatari spokesperson Mutlak Al-Qahtani spoke from the Kabul airport today through an interpreter.
Kabul airport is fully up and running. Our first concern is the safety of air navigation. However, I can clearly say this is a historic day in the history of Afghanistan, as the Kabul airport is now operational.
The Taliban has said it will allow passengers with valid travel documents to leave Afghanistan, and Washington continues to work with its allies to evacuate Americans and others still there. Qatari spokesman Mutlak Al-Qahtani said that we're entering a new phase for people wanting to leave Afghanistan.
We're not speaking about evacuation. We're speaking about the free passage. And this is not evacuation anymore. I think we want people to feel that this is normal.
Meanwhile, Afghans this weekend will be acutely aware of the 20th anniversary of 9/11. But today, September 9th, is also notorious for many Afghans. On this day, 20 years ago, Afghanistan's legendary guerrilla fighter, Ahmad Shah Massoud, was assassinated. Massoud had fought Soviet troops in the 70s, and later he fought the Taliban. Osama bin Laden coordinated his murder. Former Afghan ambassador Massoud Khalili was a close friend to Ahmad Shah Massoud. Khalili was by Massoud's side, in fact, the day he was killed. I asked Khalili what Ahmad Shah Massoud stood for.
Number one, freedom. He wanted for his country freedom. Number two, peace.
But he was also a fighter.
He said that I'm fighting to bring peace, not to love war. And he was honest. And once I told him, what you do when you finish the war? He said, I will go and finish my education. So it means now I think, wow, that man wanted peace.
Mr. Khalili, let's go back to the assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud and how it is relevant today. He was assassinated, as I said, on September 9th, 2001. Where were you that day and what happened?
Two boys came, the pretending journalists. They had a camera. They put their camera and one of them started to talk. He was half a meter, you know, away from commander. I was sitting on his right. The boy was just putting the camera very close. He asked questions, nine about Osama bin Laden, that why Commander Massoud is against him. Then the bomb. Later on, I found that he had a suicidal jacket, maybe the first suicidal jacket in the world. And then we found that, yes, Osama did that.
Osama did that, as in Osama bin Laden?
Yes. Before taking photos or something, he asked Commander Massoud, why in France you said to America, come and help us, don't abandon us, because the terrorists will come soon. He died, I survived.
So the Al-Qaeda operatives posing as journalists were killed themselves as those bombs went off. Ahmad Shah Massoud was killed. You, as you said, you were badly injured in the bombing. What exactly happened to you?
I saw that in that moment a very, very thick blue fire was coming to me, and then I felt a hand on my chest, and then I opened my eyes and I found that I've got more than 700-800 small shrapnel in my body. I lost my eye first in 1 year, a part of my leg. When I saw my wife, I asked him that first, what happened to my friend? Well, he died. I found and told myself, well, Afghanistan lost a great man. I lost a friend. I don't know what the world has lost.
As you said, Osama bin Laden was behind the assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud. What do you see as the connection between September 9th, 2001, the assassination of Massoud, and the events on 9/11?
Osama bin Laden knew, thought, and planned a suicidal bombing with the plane in America. He thought that if he does it, America will stand and take revenge in Afghanistan. And Osama knew that if Taliban do not support that, who will support it? Commander Massoud were fighting against that time against Taliban. Kill him first and then go and destroy the high towers.
Mr. Khalili, I should note that you're the son of an Afghan poet laureate. As you described, the night before Ahmad Shamsu was killed, you recited poetry together under the moon beside the Umadarya River. Take us back to that moment.
Well, it's not easy, but I'll do that for you, because that night I never forget that night at around 3:30, he said, "Let us stop talking about Al-Qaeda politics and Taliban. Let us do something for our heart." I opened the book and a beautiful verse came. Shab-e sohbat ghanimat dan ke ba'd az rozgar ma bas-e gardish kunad gardoon. Many nights come, many years go, many weekdays come, many days disappear. You two will not be able to see tomorrow each other. Take the seed of hatred from your heart now. Plant the sembling, plant the seed of love in your heart now. That's what you need.
Masoud Khalili, what do you think is the most important lesson Ahmad Shah Massoud has left behind?
Well, never and ever take everything for granted. Pay attention, especially if you are calling yourself the leaders of the world. And do it for you, for your interest, or for the interest of that country.
It really sounds like you're delivering that message to Washington specifically. When you say leaders of the world, what do you really want to say to the leaders in Washington?
What happened, happened. We cannot change it. Good things and bad things. Well, I lost 3,600 boys and girls in Afghanistan. You lost thousands of your boys and girls in Afghanistan. Let us, because of the respect of those blood that who lost their lives from California to Kandahar, to respect them, why they lost their lives, to bring for poor people freedom. Keep that. Don't leave us alone.
Masoud Khalili is a former Afghan ambassador who was close friends with and fought alongside Ahmad Shah Massoud, killed in northern Afghanistan 20 years ago today. Mr. Khalili, thank you very much for speaking with us.
God bless you. Thank you.
The past two decades since 9/11 have had a visible impact on Afghanistan. See some of the changes in a photo essay of Afghanistan in the last 20 years at theworld.org. Elvis Costello does not speak Spanish, but the singers on his new remix do.
Spanish is the other language in which rock and roll sounds great.
Elvis Costello's classic album, This Year's Model, gets waxed in Spanish. That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Some 20 years ago, not long after the September 11th attacks, the U.S. government created a centralized terrorist watch list, a tool used by government agencies to see if people they encounter are known or suspected terrorists. In the past two decades, the list has expanded a lot. The World's Monica Campbell reports now on concerns about that growth and the unintended consequences.
Priya Satvia remembers that moment when her son was pulled aside for extra screening at the airport. They were heading home to California after seeing family in India and had layovers in Singapore and Hong Kong.
They really searched his little body and his diaper. No, did you have a diaper? Whatever you
had. I don't think I had a diaper.
But they searched you like in an intrusive way, and he had a little Spider-Man backpack, which probably didn't have really anything in it.
It was 10 years ago, 2011. Satvia's son, Kabir, was 3 then.
I mean, he turned to me and he said, "But Mama, I'm not a bad guy."
He said that. They don't know why he was pulled aside, but they think it's because his name resembles someone on the U.S. terrorist watch list. They sent a query to U.S. officials and got a response.
This is a letter we got from the Department of Homeland Security.
It doesn't say why Kabir faced extra screening, but he was assigned what's called a redress number to keep him from being misidentified, the letter says. Kabir is 13 now and needs to enter that redress number before getting on a plane or crossing any border checkpoint.
Now I have this special thing that I have to enter. Like, I was a different kind of citizen.
It just seems so ridiculous, like he's marked because he has a name with an Arabic root, I'm guessing.
The FBI oversees the terrorist watch list, which was created after 9/11 and is shared with federal and local agencies. If you're stopped for speeding, chances are the cop will run your name through this database. The watch list has ballooned to well over 1 million people, and it's broken into different categories, from people on a no-fly list to people like Kabir, who can be subject to extra screening. It's a largely secret system and controversial because of the way it can disrupt people's lives.
There is very little transparency into, you know, the standards that govern inclusion on one of several federal watch lists.
Ramzi Qasem is a law professor at the City University of New York. At the Supreme Court, he represented three men with no criminal records who were on the no-fly list. They suspect it's because they refused to spy on fellow Muslim Americans. They won the case and were removed from the list, but Qasem says these abuses are shockingly common.
And nothing prevents the FBI from expanding the use of that tool. And so that's why all of us, you know, whether or not we're Muslim in America, should be worried about the existence of these sorts of mechanisms.
Qasem and other lawyers continue to fight the watch list system because they say even if you're not the criminal authorities are looking for, you still might be treated like one.
The apparatus that's been built out, you know, since 9/11 is sprawling, and it does not look like anybody is interested in shrinking that footprint and winding it down.
The FBI didn't grant an interview. In an email, a spokesperson says the watch list is updated regularly and that people are not put on it based solely on race, ethnicity, or religion. I did speak with Timothy Healy, though. He knows the watch system very well. He's a former FBI agent and ran the terrorist screening center during those first post-11 days and for years after. He was relieved when President George W. Bush authorized it.
I thought it was amazing. I mean, you know, when I looked at what it was and what it was going to do, it's about time.
He recognizes that many people linked to the watch list system are innocent. That's why the redress system exists, he says, for people like Kabir, the 13-year-old, to get a chance to say, hey, I shouldn't be on any list. For its part, the FBI doesn't want agents wasting time screening 3-year-olds either, he says.
We're in the business to identify a known or suspected terrorist and make sure that the agencies and the people there do it. That's the whole purpose.
Healy says people being misidentified or any abuse within the system must be addressed quickly, but he doesn't want to lose sight of the larger goal. In California, Priya Satvia understands why after 9/11, the government would move to increase surveillance, but she still has questions about the impact of that surveillance on innocent people like her son.
Since it sort of made me wonder, like, oh, when Kabir starts applying for those adult things like a driver's license and stuff, like, is this going to appear somewhere? Or I don't know, like, what it's going to mean as he becomes an adult.
She knows other people have faced far more disruptions from winding up on the wrong list and wonders whether this will be an ongoing legacy of 9/11. For The World, I'm Monica Campbell, Palo Alto, California.
The events of 9/11 touched the lives of just about everyone here in the U.S., especially American Muslims. 20 years ago, Khalid Latif was a sophomore at New York University. He's now the executive director and chaplain for the Islamic Center at NYU. Khalid Latif, you and other NYU students saw the second plane go into the tower. Where were you on September 11th, 2001, and what are your strongest memories from that day?
You know, I was actually on my way to a class that starts pretty early in the morning. As I walked into the building, a security guard came to the doorway saying, "We have to evacuate the building. A plane has flown into the World Trade Center." Moments before, I was cutting through Washington Square Park, which is at the center of NYU's campus, and it was pretty much empty. And now I walked into a gathering of about 10 or 12,000 of my fellow NYU students, and we were all standing, looking downtown as the second plane flew into the towers. I returned back to my dorm, and I overheard people who lived on a floor with me saying things to the effect of, we should get all of the Muslims together and send them out of this country so that things like this don't happen.
So people were saying that already on September 11th.
Yeah. We had media from all over the world that was engaging us, wanting to know, what do Muslims think? And we now became representative of all Muslims from all backgrounds around the world. And there was just a lot of precautions that we had to take as students at that time. We created a buddy system so that no one would have to walk around on their own who was a Muslim student.
As a Muslim American, though, I mean, as you said, you began feeling the blowback immediately. And you've worked basically since that time building bridges between Muslim Americans and other groups. How did your experiences post 9/11 inspire that work?
I've had a lot of different experiences attached to the tragedies of 9/11. I think it made it very evident that even this construct of a Muslim American was something now that was coming to the surface that I think exists within this kind of good, bad type framework, good Muslim, bad Muslim, moderate, extremist. There's very few people who are able to just call themselves American without a hyphen of some kind or a dash that pre-qualifies their Americanness. And now there became a deep dive into Muslims having to identify just how American they actually were. It became something that was evident, especially within immigrant Muslim communities. I've had many members of my community who are from all walks of life tell me that federal law enforcement visits them in their office, has come to their house. They don't know how to respond. Members of our community who dealt with their homes being raided and family members being tied up for really no reason given to them.
These are realities that have been visited upon you, Khalid. When you were just 24, you became the chaplain for the New York Police Department. I know you shared a lot of stories about being surveilled and profiled as a Muslim man, some of them painful, some kind of absurd. But you have a particular account of being profiled while in uniform. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So, you know, on the 9th anniversary of the September 11th attacks, this is in 2010, I, as a chaplain for the police department and participating in the 9/11 memorial service, we would start out the day by having breakfast with family members who lost loved ones on that day. We then take a bus down to the Ground Zero site, and I'm in my police uniform, an inspector's uniform, but I still have a beard. I have my head covered. Three men approach me wearing suits saying that Secret Service has spotted you from the top of a building. They want us to check your credentials just in case. And I said, just in case what? And they said, we're sorry that we're doing this to you. And I said, then why are you doing it? And, you know, to understand what they're questioning in that moment is not just my physical presence at this location, but the entire validity of my emotion attached to this space, right? Where I was a student at New York University on September 11th in 2001. I did watch the second plane fly into the towers. I stood at funerals for people of my faith and other walks of life who died on that day. And in that moment, these men are questioning the validity of all of it.
When the feds pulled you aside, did you get any support from your fellow NYPD colleagues?
Well, who I got support was from a mother who had lost her son on September 11th. She intervened and said to these men that what you are doing right now is more dishonorable to the memory of our loved ones that we lost on that day than anything else. Mm. That here this young man is standing with us in our moment of need, and you're making it seem as if he's doing something wrong just because he's Muslim. And as easily as they had taken the validation away, she brought it right back.
So that was the 9th anniversary of 9/11 when you were a chaplain with the NYPD. The country then saw a rise in anti-Muslim, really extremism, before and during the Trump presidency. How would you characterize things today generally for Muslim American communities?
I think the Muslim community in the United States is a multifaceted community. And the direct engagement that we have with most forms of government tend to put us in a security box or an immigration box, and those boxes alone. I do think that there's still, on an individual level, realities that people face. I think there's definitely a lot more that can be done to ensure that civil rights, basic human rights of Muslims in the United States, are not things that get curtailed anymore, right? am not in a place for myself personally where I'm worried, for example, that anyone's going to take my 6-year-old son or my 8-year-old daughter away from me. But I walk out of my house with an understanding that on any given day, someone might take me away from my family.
Khalid, what for you feels different about this 20th anniversary of 9/11, if anything?
You know, we're coming out of a pandemic. Global realities that are geopolitical are things that the world is more aware of now because of social media. There's opportunity for us to see just how deeply connected and linked we are, and that interdependence is going to be a key factor in us being able to overcome any challenge. But it's going to take a lot of people being willing to just listen to the lived experiences of those that are different from them, and in a true pursuit of empathy. And I think, you know, there are more people that are getting to that place.
Khalid Latif is executive director and chaplain for the Islamic Center at New York University. He's been speaking with us from New York City. Khalid, thank you very much. Greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you.
New faces in the classroom as the school year kicks off in the U.S. Some of those faces are newly arrived refugee children. Many encounter struggles because of language barriers and trauma. In this next story, we hear how one woman from East Africa, born in a refugee camp, navigated school in the U.S. She excelled, but not without serious challenges. Reporter Ben James of the New England News Collaborative has our story.
It was snowing when Rubila Abdullahi first arrived at her new home in Springfield, Massachusetts in 2005.
Oh boy, was that terrifying. White stuff falling from the sky, freezing. On top of that, I was surrounded by people that were not my color. So I just remember being really scared and just holding on to my mom's dress.
Abdullahi was 7 years old. Her family had just spent 12 years in refugee camps in Kenya, escaping persecution because they are Somali Bantu, a group of marginalized tribes. Now thousands of Somali Bantus were being resettled across the U.S. Nellie Tran studied the experiences of these refugees as they entered public schools. She's an associate professor in the School of Education at San Diego State University.
The children, the adults, the teachers, the staff, the school, everyone was discovering where the clashes were along the way.
Clashes or just basic challenges? The newly arrived children needed to be shown how doorknobs worked. They resisted being separated from their siblings.
The schools kept saying that they had never experienced this type of situation. And they had lots of experience working with refugees and immigrants.
Rumbila Abdullahi says her older siblings struggled with middle school, a hard time for most kids, while Rumbila quickly mastered the customs of first grade and gained fluency in English. She filled out official forms for her parents, translated their conversations with doctors, a role she still plays, like last year, when her mom was admitted to the hospital with symptoms of congestive heart failure.
The cardiologist was like, she needs to get a pacemaker. Without it, she's probably not going to last a year. And trying to explain that to my mom was very hard. She was like, no, they're trying to take my organs. I was like, Mom, no, that's not what it is.
Abdullahi is now 23 and married. Her husband was also born in the Kenyan camps. Her goal? To become a doctor and serve the Somali Bantu American community. This spring, she was finishing up her senior year, pre-med, at Smith College, an elite 4-year institution in Massachusetts. Abdullahi ran track at Smith. She made friends, got good grades. But she also says she felt like an outsider at times.
Sometimes I'll be the only Black student in my class, or even the only one that was Muslim.
She was a married commuter on a full scholarship. And she felt the weight of her parents' trauma in Somalia and Kenya, their struggles here in the States.
They're like, you know what I've been through? Yeah. So you better be doing good in school. Being drilled with that as a young girl and growing up and going to Smith, I carried that with me, you know?
While Abdullahi's family supported her education, they also assumed she'd keep to their ideas of a traditional Somali Bantu wife, cooking for her husband, staying home, not leaving much room to become a doctor. That's a reality Professor Nellie Tran in San Diego understands, coming from a Vietnamese refugee family herself.
We carry a huge burden. The immense pressure to find yourself as you go through college and go through your own personal development while staying connected to the people who you love the most and who also have probably created the most pain for you is really hard.
In May, shortly after taking the medical college admissions tests and wrapping up her coursework, Abdullahi gave birth to her first child, Nabil. And 2 weeks after that, it was graduation.
Hampshire House.
Woo!
Rumbila Abdullahi.
Woo! You did it! You did it!
Abdullahi's husband, Ibrahim Abdi, watched the ceremony from home with the baby.
Nabil, mommy graduated. 4 years of hard work.
A young woman taking care of her family and her community, depending on them, and shedding their expectations, all at the same time. For The World, I'm Ben James in Springfield, Massachusetts.
Elvis Costello burst onto the music scene in 1977. A year later, he released one of his classics, This Year's Model, with tracks like Pump It Up. Today, a new version of This Year's Model is coming out, this one in Spanish. Spanish Model is reimagined by an assortment of stars from the world of rock en español, artists like Colombia's Juanes. Spanish Model was created by Elvis Costello and Latin Grammy Award-winning Sebastian Criss. Elvis spoke to us from New York. Sebastian joined us from Los Angeles.
You know, for me, it was an opportunity to expose Elvis's music to a brand new audience and a brand new generation in a brand new way. So, you know, I'm a fan of that album. And first, it's kind of like opening up Noah's Ark. I mean, it's like when you get to peek behind how things were done and what things really sound like, it's a real treat as a producer.
For you, Elvis, why Spanish? I mean, I my thought goes back to the Beatles and recording I Want to Hold Your Hand in German. Why?
Yeah, but that didn't sound that great. You know, our friend Nick Lowe says a very smart thing. Spanish is the other language in which rock and roll sounds great. And so much music that I love has rebounded back and forward between different continents. And of course, when you talk about a country that has a massive Spanish-speaking population like the United States, there are lots of great records that are, you know, cross the border in that sense or straddle the border. I didn't think there was anything particularly odd about that. My own father sang in Spanish and a number of other languages as a radio dance band singer. I never did learn how to speak anything other than a few courtesy words in any language. So I really was trusting Sebastian's judgment, but also the integrity and the humor and the wit and the intelligence of all of our collaborators lyrically. So I'm thrilled to hear what they're bringing out of it. And they've just, everybody's done it with such generosity.
What about instrumental trademarks, Sebastian, like organ and the beat? I mean, did you feel free to elaborate on the originals beyond even what one might recognize?
Well, it didn't feel like a period piece. It felt modern to me. It just the groove and the way the band played. You know, after I got my hands on the tracks, I told Elvis, you know, I'd love to go into a studio with a four-piece band and no click track and make a record like this, because it was just the energy of it is so relevant to me. And it sounds like it could have been recorded yesterday, except that no one plays like that anymore.
Sebastian did an incredible job in realizing the instrumental mix in relation to the different sound of the guest singers, that their voices functioned in a different way in the music. And also to just bring a slightly different perspective to allow the band to actually sound even more powerful in some cases, because I wasn't taking up so much space with all my attitude. And the band, I think, really shines, you know, and you can hear details in the mix, some of which they weren't obscured. They were just arranged differently in the original balance. And now we can really hear what they're doing.
So Elvis Costello, were you bringing in new guitar lines for this album?
No, there's no added music at all. There's only new voices. And I believe we created, we repeated some of the drum pattern to allow Fuego to add his verses in Chelsea. There's a slight addition, like we simply duplicated some of the, isn't that right, Sebastian? You just duplicated yeah. some of the rhythm. Yo no quiero tu ropa cara de moda. Yo vivo la vida a mi manera y ahora. Yo no quiero ir a Chelsea, baby, así. Me veo perfectamente bien como nace. Some remix albums try to add voguish sounds to old records. You hear it with jazz remixes quite a lot. Sometimes it's an interesting experiment, but it has to be done with great understanding. There was no need to add anything to the band. The band's playing just great. What's, to me, interesting about this and has its own charm and wit is hearing all of these different singers take on the story of the songs and also not just singing a literal translation, but singing an adaptation. Sometimes being as bold as to change the story or change the emphasis of the story.
Sebastian, Chris, and I'm going to ask Elvis Costello the same question. Did you understand something different about Elvis's songs in Spanish that hadn't occurred to you before this project?
You know, I thought it was great to hear a song like No Action being sung from the point of view of a woman, whereas as a young man, when I first heard that song, you know, it resonated with me. But it can resonate both ways. It can resonate in any way, gender specific or not. And I think that that's an important discovery in this record. No quiero besarte, no
quiero tocar. That's a very good thing to say, because when you're 24, you're working out your own thoughts. And I'm writing these songs down. But the people that are not working out their ideas on the page or in music, and they're just hearing them, they're entitled to interpret them as representing something they feel. And it's true to say that, there's a melodiousness to some of these renditions that perhaps heightens some of the poignant ideas in the lyrics. And it equally, Nina Diaz's version is not, there's nothing poignant about that. She throws herself at it with the same fury as I did. In some ways, I would say more. And so I love the fact that they had such an open mind about getting inside that song, using those tools, you know, using those instruments and trying to fit their voices in with that.
Elvis Costello and producer Sebastian Chris. The album is called Spanish Model, an all-Spanish version of Elvis Costello's 1978 debut with his band The Attractions, this year's model. Thank you both very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It is our turn now to take action and draw the curtains on today's show. You can listen to some of the music from Spanish Model on our Spotify playlist, as well as other great music we've featured. You can link to it on our Twitter feed. We are at The World. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.